We'll go on with item 9, Scott River TMDL. Update on the implementation plan.
Brian McFadden, Regional Board Staff. Good afternoon. Chairman Anderson and members of the board. I'm here today to give you an update on progress in implementing the Scott TMDL and specifically some information regarding some action plan deliverables as well as a schedule of implementation activities that this board requested back in October. So I put together this agenda to do that, and I'm going to give a brief history and background of the TMDL and the process, and then go through the three items that are action plan deliverables, and then we'll have a discussion about the schedule of implementation activities that we've prepared in response to your request, talk about some next steps, and then I'll be very happy to receive your comments. The Scott River watershed was placed on the 303D list of impaired water bodies in 1992, and that began
on the lands they own in that area. The tribe has not been able to sell timber in recent years. They did sell timber years ago. They had one purchaser out of Oregon. And, you know, I think the reason Green Diamond personally and as an economist and as a guy that's worked in timber for 30-some years, I believe that this land is uneconomical under most economic conditions in terms of producing timber. So if timber harvest is relied on to service the debt, I think, you know, Troy can confirm that there have been timber sales offered in recent years and prepared that there's no buyers for. The biggest concern is sovereign immunity. The tribe enjoys and deserves, in my opinion, sovereign immunity from prosecution. The only time that that doesn't apply is when they give up a limited or general waiver of sovereign immunity. So if some future council decided that they wanted to change, accelerate logging on these lands, or do whatever, build roads, unless there is in the deal somewhere a limited waiver of sovereign immunity, nobody would have an opportunity to go to court to challenge that kind of management. Now, this, to my mind, doesn't get, I mean, you know, a federal appropriation, I would support it for purchasing these lands for this deal. You know, foundation funding, I would support it. By the way, I live on the reservation. I live at Klamath Glen, which is, this is the Klamath Glen Hydrologic Unit. The other thing is that these clean water funds need to be used for things that are clearly going to give us clean water and improve us. And I would note that in Klamath, where the tribe is located, the sewage system is a disaster waiting to happen. Your staff could confirm this. The facility's old. It has problems. There have been findings on it by your staff. We don't have money to clean up these small rural systems. And actually, the leach field for this system is in the floodplain, and half of it went in one of the past storms. It's been damaged in recent storms. And one of these days, you know, there's a storm going to come along and take out the rest of that leach field. It needs to be relocated. There's lands for sale that it could be relocated to. And, you know, I would hope the tribe would be applying for clean water money to help the local district do some of that. So, you know, I think that the devil's in the details on this one. And the real question is Clean Water Act funding this particular pile of funding, is this the proper place for this project, which, you know, I think is a good project. I personally support the tribe's aspirations and hope you will support them, but that doesn't alter the question of whether this is a good source, this is a good source of funding for that project. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Good questions and part of the record, and heard this as an informational item. Anyone else on item 8? Not. We'll go on with item 9, Scott River TMDL. Update on the implementation plan.
Brian McFadden, Regional Board staff. Good afternoon, Chairman Anderson and members of the board. I'm here today to give you an update on progress in implementing the Scott TMDL and specifically some information regarding some action plan deliverables, as well as a schedule of implementation activities that this board requested back in October. So I put together this agenda to do that, and I'm going to give a brief history and background of the TMDL and the process, and then go through the three items that are action plan deliverables, and then we'll have a discussion about the schedule of implementation activities that we've prepared in response to your request, talk about some next steps, and then I'll be very happy to receive your comments. The Scott River watershed was placed on the 303D list of impaired water bodies in 1992, and that began a process that culminated in 2006 with the adoption of the Scott River TMDL Action Plan and also the adoption of a conditional waiver by this board. I shouldn't really say that the process culminated there because we're in process, but at least the adoption stopped there. For now, the main points of the Scott TMDL are to control excess sediment discharges, increase riparian shade to keep the water cool, and better understand how groundwater use affects stream temperatures. I mentioned the conditional waiver. It's very important and an integral part of this regulatory program, and it basically says that, if landowners who are participating in ongoing activities and collaborative processes to further the goals of the TMDL have coverage under for their discharges incident to their activities. It does not, however, cover the discharges that are already addressed in other programs. And importantly, it expires in August 2011. As you know, waivers are only good for 5 years, and that's when this waiver will need to be revised. So the first of the action plan deliverables I want to discuss relates to, in the action plan it says that we're to develop criteria for when we would require an erosion control plan. But having thought about this, we realized that the vast majority of sediment sources, human-caused sediment sources in the watershed, are already addressed by processes that are in place or are moving forward. And in the end, will result in a process that serves the same function as an erosion control plan. So the private timberlands in the watershed are addressed in two ways. First, the timber harvest plan. As you know, timber operators are required to develop an erosion control plan for timber harvest plans as part of that process in compliance with the waste discharge requirements for timber. There's another effort that has just gotten underway to address private timber roads that are outside of those timber harvest plans. It's a project that the Scott River Watershed Council has begun with the assistance of the Northern California Resource Center and some seed money that we've been able to establish. I'll get into that a little later. Forest Service lands, the sediment discharges from Forest Service lands are being addressed through the MOU and permits that will follow from that, and I'll explain the details of that also. Siskiyou County roads are a source of sediment, certainly, and we have a process in place to address those through the waste discharge requirements that we're developing. Likewise, Caltrans Highway 3 is a source of sediment, and we have a process in place to address that. There's more work to do there with Caltrans, but there's a process that we can work with to accomplish that. Of course, any ground disturbance greater than an acre requires a construction stormwater permit, and part of that is a stormwater pollution prevention plan, which functions as an erosion control plan. That really captures the majority of human-caused sediment sources in this basin. And those occur in the uplands, in the mountains, as opposed to the valley. But we also have a process that I'm going to describe a little bit to also address the agricultural sources. And so with all that put together, we feel like we've got a handle on the major sources of sediment in the watershed. But there are always oddballs, and for those types of sources, we'll address them through our own observations. And when we see a situation, sediment situation in stream that we can track back to a source, when we receive complaints about a sediment source, we'll follow up and address those issues as we're able to. Now turning the attention to another action plan deliverable. The action plan says that we're to develop criteria for when we would require a grazing and riparian management plan. So that's one need. There's another need, which is compliance with the non-point source policy. The non-point source policy says that all non-point source discharges must be covered by a prohibition, a waiver, or a permit consistent with Port of Cologne. And so putting those two needs together, we're recommending that we skip the criteria and just get straight to a regulatory program that would serve the function of controlling those pollutant sources. So this chart here is meant to illustrate where we're going with this in the Scott. Currently, we have the general conditional waiver that I described before. It says if you're participating, you're covered for your discharges. Well, we need to begin to split out specific activities and address those specifically. And so we're moving towards a situation where we'll still have some revised general waiver, but then we'll also have waivers and permits that address specific situations or categories of activities. And we're starting with agricultural issues near streams. So this is the proposed framework that we've come up with. It follows on some of the other work that we've done in the past, although many aspects of it are brand new. Our process that we're proposing is to define enrollment criteria for who would qualify for a waiver versus a WDR. And we would craft those criteria based on threat to water quality. And the considerations that we'll make in defining those criteria are things related to proximity of livestock to streams and their access to streams, as well as the proximity of other agricultural activities near the stream. Of course, the vegetation condition is important, relates to sediment and temperature. And all that is superimposed on the landscape and the sensitivity of the specific location. Those are the types of things that we're going to be dealing with and trying to define those criteria. We're also going to be relying, consulting with local stakeholders to make sure that what we put together makes sense for the way that people operate in Scott Valley and is also in the same kind of language that people use in Scott Valley. And I also want to say that this isn't something that we're going to be inventing from scratch. We're not going to reinvent the wheel here. There's been an extensive program in the past that the State Board was involved in, along with the Farm Bureau, Cattlemen's Association, and UC Cooperative Extension. That process resulted in quite a lot of information about best management practices and a lot of informational material that landowners can use. There's a great website that came out of it. We're going to be using some of that information where it's appropriate and crafting this program using already accepted sorts of approaches, and also be consulting with Board Member Harris and taking advantage of her great knowledge on this subject. Right now we're thinking that enrollment will be based on either having a plan in place that could be a riparian management erosion control plan that we define, or it could be a ranch plan or some other third-party developed plan that we've looked at and agreed that it meets the need. And similar to what's in the Garcia TMDL implementation plan, we hope to develop a suite of standardized BMPs so that if a landowner for some reason doesn't want to develop a plan for their own particular situation, they can commit to prescribed set of BMPs, and we will know that they're covered. So the next step would be approaching landowners. And the first step there would be identifying which landowners we think need coverage. And that's really a mapping exercise. At that point, we'd send a letter out to those landowners that have been identified. This is going to be similar to what we did in the Shasta, where we have a letter that explains the program and provides landowners a checklist so that they can self-identify the issues that they're grappling with. And we're going to request that they send us back a letter of intent describing what their plans are to move forward in this process. From those responses, then we can come up with a sort of preliminary categorization and put people in the boxes of no threat to water quality, no waiver permit needed, minimal threat to water quality, going to need a waiver, and landowners who pose a substantial threat, we're going to work with them first to see if we can get them into that minimal threat category so that they can qualify for the waiver, so that hopefully we don't have to issue WDRs. And then it's about administering the program from there. So the third item that is an action plan deliverable that I wanted to talk about today is the compliance and trend monitoring plan for the Scott. I'm happy to say the compliance and trend monitoring plan is now out on the street and on our website. The public review draft is available, and we're accepting comments. It's a plan that is geared to evaluate progress in attaining water quality standards related to sediment and temperature. And to do that, it describes the types of parameters that we think need to be monitored and locations, frequency, et cetera. When we have a final plan, we plan to submit that plan to the Klamath Basin Water Quality Monitoring Coordination Group so that it can be incorporated into a larger basin-wide plan. So that concludes the discussion of the action plan deliverables. And so moving on to the schedule of implementation activities this board requested. I want to point out that it really represents two efforts, the schedule. The first effort was my own to document what we're doing and the types of things that are in the action plan that we're scheduled to do. Part of that schedule represents the efforts of the Watershed Council to define what they plan to be doing between now and 2011 when the waiver expires. So this is kind of the background of how this came to be. Of course, in October, you requested this plan be developed. In January, we approached the Watershed Council and were able to present at a Watershed Council executive committee meeting that was open to the public and very well attended. And at that meeting, they committed to developing their part of the schedule that they submitted. They did that and developed the schedule. It was approved by the Siskiyou RCD, and then they submitted it to us, and I appended it to the schedule that I made. I want to point out that it represents the activities of a number of groups, not just the Regional Board and the Watershed Council, but it, through the Watershed Council's process and our own program, it covers quite a large group of entities. So this first item, I have to admit, is the one that doesn't fit in very well. It's not related to what the Watershed Council is doing, and we're not really directing it. It's a county process, and that's the process to develop the land disturbance manual that they have drafted. It's called out in the action plan, or something akin to it is, rather. And the status of this is that the county planning department has lost some staff recently. They're down to one planner, and although it remains a high priority, I've been assured, it's something that's on hold. I don't think I mentioned, but I'm going to start with the staff-directed part of the schedule. So, as I mentioned and you're aware, we've been developing a memorandum of understanding with the Forest Service, the Klamath National Forest, pursuant to the action plan. And we've got a MOU drafted. It's very near to signing, although there's still some adjustments that may occur. And I should mention that after this schedule was developed and put on the website, we had a request from the Forest Service to move back some of these dates by about 6 months. So I just want you to be aware of that wrinkle. But going through this list of activities, the Forest Service has agreed to inventory their sediment sources, both road-related and non-road-related, and come up with a priority list for those sediment sources, and, the order in which they would address them, as well as develop a schedule for when those repairs would occur, and develop a document that describes how they do what they do to keep sediment out of the streams. Similarly, they'd be developing, or they would be committing to implementing their water quality programs and riparian buffer widths that we feel are a great thing for water quality, as well as conduct monitoring to ensure that sediment sources are being controlled. Likewise, they'd be doing some monitoring to ensure that the riparian reserve buffer widths are working when they have a project near streams. And then there's another set of items related to grazing. They're going to be describing the grazing management practices and how they ensure that water quality is going to be protected there, and submitting that to us, as well as conducting monitoring to ensure that those practices are working, and then they've committed to conduct adaptive management based on the results of that monitoring. We just discussed the criteria for riparian management plans and erosion control plans and our approach to that, so I won't spend any more time on that. I've included the dairy permitting framework that has been before you previously because while it's a region-wide program, it would apply to Scott Valley because there is a dairy there in Scott Valley. There's at least one. My understanding is the second isn't operational at the moment, but at any rate, that's something that we're looking at in terms of compliance in the Scott as well. And so I've included it here. Also, we have the compliance and trend monitoring plan I just discussed, so I won't discuss that now. As you know, we're developing waste discharge requirements for county roads. We anticipate bringing that in front of the board for adoption in September. Also in September, the action plan states that we are to have evaluated suction dredging by that point, and we intend to do so. And then finally, the action plan says that after 5 years, there's going to be an evaluation of how well the locally directed efforts have addressed the TMDL concerns. So I've added that to the schedule. And related to that is the revision of the waste discharge or the waiver. And whatever other actions we take related to waivers is also implicit there. So now I want to turn the attention to the portion of the schedule of implementation activities that was submitted to us by the Watershed Council and the RCD. And I just want to note that we have representatives from both the RCD and the Watershed Council in attendance, should you have questions. The first item that they've proposed or submitted is related to reporting of information under the terms of the Fish and Game's Watershed-Wide Permitting Program. The RCD is going to be submitting an annual report of their activities, and so they'll be also submitting that to this board. And some of the discussion that occurred at the January meeting had to do with the community's feeling that they hadn't done a well enough job of promoting the work that they had been doing and capturing all the things that individuals had been doing to implement the TMDL, and so they're going to develop a database to capture that work and track it. The second item in this portion of the schedule is the groundwater study. And there's a number of items related to the groundwater study. On this slide here, the RCD and Watershed Council are saying that they'll explore implementation of the piezometer network that has been called out as a need in the groundwater study plan, and promote involvement by the local community, facilitate cooperation, and seek money to install the piezometer network. Likewise, they'll be assisting with monitoring and maintenance once the piezometer network is installed. By September, we anticipate that UC Davis will have completed the initial phase of model development for the aquifer in Scott Valley. And some other items on this list are expansion of the monitoring network and the monitoring well network that that they've begun. They've got somewhere between 30 and 35 wells that they're monitoring currently, and they're hoping to expand that network. And then they're also committing to submit a participation report to this board on an annual basis. this item here, sediment reduction strategies, really reflects the efforts of the private timberland owners that are involved with the Watershed Council. And I believe that's all the timberland owners in the watershed. The first item reflects their commitment to do the items that are required under the general waste discharge requirements for timber, which is consistent with TMDL implementation. The second item relates to their efforts to seek funding to address sediment sources outside of timber harvest plants. On the topic of riparian planting, the RCD and Watershed Council will be developing a schedule and strategy for riparian planting for the project that they've applied to complete under 319H. That schedule and strategy will be completed by the end of the year, and I'm happy to say that that grant was awarded to the Watershed Council after this schedule was developed, so they just got word within the last week that they'll be receiving those funds. Those funds will go a long ways towards planting the 20 acres of riparian vegetation that's identified in the third item. The final item on this page relates to the private timberland owners' efforts to implement the shade allocations that are expressed in the temperature TMDL, consistent with the way that we're implementing our timber harvest program. On the topic of riparian fencing, the RCD, with their partners, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, will be fencing an average of 2 miles per year. This is something that comes straight out of the Fish and Game's watershed-wide permitting program. And just a little while ago in the hallway, I got some information that the second item here, which actually says C, was shouldn't be there. So please ignore that. They're going to fence the 2 miles regardless of whether they get the grants. And they're going to collect that information and report it back to us through their database that they're developing. The Watershed Council is also committing to some public outreach and education, and they want to hold some workshops. It says one or more of these. I know that one of them is going to happen because I'm going to be giving it, and that's in a month. I'm sure they're going to be seeking to have more of these workshops. But that's definitely one of their goals, is to reach the community through these workshops. Another item that the Watershed Council and RCD submitted has to do with fuels reduction, and although it's not something that's called out in the action plan or the TMDL staff report, it's something that the Watershed Council feels is relevant and pertinent. And so part of the Watershed Council activities are going to be fuels reduction and creation of fuel breaks. And finally, there's an item here that they've called their Upland Committee, which I don't think describes it very well, so I'll try to do that. This is the effort that I mentioned earlier in the presentation, where the private timberland owners have gotten together and are also going to be working with the Forest Service to address the sediment sources that exist outside of the timber harvest plan areas. And the approach there is to look at the landscape and take account of where there have been sediment inventories completed, and of those locations, where have the sediment reduction projects been been completed. So there's the inventory of what needs to be done. There's also what has been done. That leaves the third category of what hasn't, where has there not been anything done to characterize the sediment sources. And then based on that information, this group is going to be developing a prioritization for where to go first to deal with those sediment sources in a comprehensive way. You know, it's a comprehensive strategy to deal with those sediment sources in a way that makes sense and is logical. And it's something that we're really happy about. This is what we've been looking for, this sort of self-directed process to address something that was identified in the action plan. And so to that end, we contributed just short of $5,000 to get the ball rolling on this. And the first item there has already been completed. That's the draft plan, and I have it for review. So we put this chart together. That concludes the schedule of implementation activities. But we put this table together to kind of help walk through each one of those items and give our take on how it relates to compliance with the waiver, and I've added a comment on each. The reporting item isn't something that the action plan calls out, nor does the waiver require it. But nonetheless, it's important, and we want to see that happen and want to support it as we can. The groundwater study is a situation where we feel like there's a great process in place, and the assistance that the Watershed Council has gotten from UC Davis has been great, and the RCD staff time that has been put into assisting UC Davis has been well worth the effort. But there's an issue now related to the data set that they really need to move forward, and that gets back to access and outreach and community buy-in. It's kind of gotten stalled, I would say, or slowed down in these discussions about having community buy-in before a larger effort goes forward to collect data. And so I see the need for that to be resolved so that robust data set can be developed and the process can move forward. The item related to private timber's sediment reduction strategy, what they do in the timber harvest plans is already covered by the timber waste discharge requirements, so it doesn't relate to the waiver. Although I should say that currently the way the waiver is worded, the fixes that they're doing outside of their timber harvest plans would be covered by the waiver, which isn't reflected there. We feel like that process is working, particularly with the timber harvest plan process. I don't think I need to say more about that. In regard to the riparian planting, right now, all that we can see in terms of a program in place is this one riparian planting project. And there really needs to be a comprehensive strategy to move forward with this really important activity. The questions of where to plant next and why there need to be answered. It needs to be worked out on a watershed scale. Similarly, with repairing fencing, it's hard for me to say how that relates to waiver compliance because 2 miles a year, I recognize that's a lot of work. What I can't do is put that into context of whether or not that's in the right places or is that progress that will lead to compliance with the TMDL. in a reasonable amount of time. So, again, there needs to be a strategy there. I know that Fish and Game is going to be requiring prioritization as part of their permitting process, but currently there's nothing like that that exists, and so it's hard to say how that complies with the waiver or provides an avenue for compliance. On the topic of outreach and education, it doesn't really relate to the waiver, but it's very important, and we're going to continue to support that. And similarly, the fuels reduction projects that they're talking about, I don't think those apply to the waiver either, but it does represent a great outreach opportunity for ourselves. There's a number of fire safe councils that have formed in the watershed that meet on a regular basis, and it's my intention to attend those fire safe councils, present our program, and hopefully get some momentum there. The Upland Committee, which is really the private timber, I keep saying private timber, but the Forest Service is involved with that too. The Upland Timber Areas efforts to address their sediment sources outside of THPs is a great project, and we're going to continue to support that, and that absolutely constitutes waiver compliance in our eyes. So, moving on to the next steps, we're going to be continuing to do many of the things that we're already doing. That relates to those ongoing efforts related to the roads and our other programs, timber enforcement and developing the permitting program. We need to finalize the compliance and trend monitoring plan. Fish and Game has a process that they're working through related to suction dredging, and we're going to track that to see if we can piggyback onto their process to address that concern. We're going to have to develop these permits that I described previously. That's going to be a lot of work. It'll keep us busy. And that's going to involve a lot of landowner contact and outreach. And that's kind of a full plate, I think. So this board requested that we develop the schedule of implementation activities that addresses planned or required activities between now and 2011 when the waiver expires. We've presented a schedule, and we're very interested in hearing your feedback about the content of the schedule. Is it what you had in mind? And if not, what should staff be doing to further the implementation of the Scott TMDL? As well as what additional actions should local stakeholders take to implement the TMDL action plan? Those are the questions topics I'd like to hear your comments about, as well as any other comments you have. And that's the end of my presentation.
Okay, thank you, Brian. I've been advised we have a board member needs to leave at 3:00. I have two speaker cards, or I could entertain board member comments from that board member wanted at the head of the speakers. All right, I'm going to go on. We have a couple of cards, and then we'll come back to have a staff discussion. Again, it's an informational item. We can provide you some information, I suspect. Felice.
My name is Felice Pace. I own a house and some land in Scott Valley, and I'm speaking for myself today. I got to say I'm a little disappointed in the presentation, and I don't know if I heard it right or not. I think I heard that the staff has decided, the implementation plan says that the staff will develop criteria for when to require
sediment plans and WDRs, and I think I heard the staff say that they had decided that wasn't necessary, that there's some process out there with the timber companies that's starting up, and that's going to be good enough. And I don't know, is that the staff changing the basin plan? They also, I think I heard there was no need to address private timber roads, that was being taken care of. I guess I heard a reference to complaints, so I guess we'll have to make a lot more of them. I also think I heard that staff had decided that the implementation plan says criteria will be developed for when grazing plans are required, and staff has decided to change that as well. I wonder why it's so difficult to tell people they have to stop allowing their cattle to trample the stream banks and eat the riparian vegetation, including the trees. Why is that so difficult? Why is that not feasible in the Scott River Valley? I didn't really see a schedule that tied to the basin plan schedule, and that where I could see that we were going to get to the accomplishments we're supposed to get to by 2011. Forest Service wants a 6-month extension. What else is new? Draft plan for private sediment. Lots of plans. It's great, lots of planning, but I don't see much in the way of implementation. And the idea that, riparian fencing and revegetation that's been going on for many years, I've pointed out to this group before, and I have photos of how these fences get taken down, how there is not good criteria for what you're required to maintain in terms of cattle exclusion. And I wonder if any of these new projects are going to have any criteria that require the landowner in order to get the project to agree on exclusion. That has been missing generally in this watershed. And I was one of the founders, by the way, of the predecessor of the Watershed Council. A couple other comments here. By the way, the report that he was talking about was put on the website this week, so I haven't had a lot of time to go through it. I printed it out and brought it with me today and worked on it a little bit. But the reliance on the proposed fish and game watershed-wide permit. If you read the papers up there, and I do, you know that it's very controversial from both sides of the spectrum, you might say. From the property rights, people are very against it, the Grange and so forth, and the environmental groups are considering litigating it, and because of the precedent it sets and its inadequacy. And reliance on a proposed fish and game watershed-wide permitting program to do your job or the staff's job just strikes me as something that doesn't make much sense. This plan has not passed CEQA's muster as of yet, and many of us think it's questionable whether it ever will. In terms of the groundwater study, I did have the opportunity to attend one of the meetings in the valley, and it looks like a good study to me. I mean, they're having trouble getting the amount of pezeometers and well monitoring out there that they would like, but they're looking at a Cadillac system, which may yield us some results someday. There was a plea for those additional locations. But I did sense in that meeting that there is a less denial about that there are actually impacts to stream flows and temperature and so forth from groundwater. So I think some of the education is getting through, and I did notice that. I did also notice that there is, now a new holy grail, and that's to dam the wilderness lakes. There are dams on a few of them, but to raise those dams and store lots of cold water upstream so that we can continue doing what we're doing in the valley and take care of these agencies as well. The Wilderness Act, they run into a couple problems with the Wilderness Act that make that infeasible in my view. In terms of the county as a partner, we heard that the land use manual has not gone through because of staffing problems. But this is the April 15th edition of the Mount Shasta Herald, Fire Safe Council's Question Intent of County Ordinance. They did have time to do a county ordinance to basically get control of the fire safe councils. And I think, I suspect this upland committee has something to do with this because the local supervisor over there thinks that we can accelerate logging for fire risk reduction. And I think she's a little upset because some of the fire safe councils are intent on protecting their communities and not on advancing the idea of logging for fire risk reduction. So that's very interesting because this is, of course, a county that believes in local control, and we heard that a lot when we were preparing the TMDL, but they want to take local control away from the fire safe councils. Interesting. I mentioned that the compliance and monitoring plan has just been issued for public comment. I look forward to reviewing that. So in general, I think, I see a lot of talk, some documents, mostly in draft form, and I don't think we're not going to get there by 2011, but I hope I'm wrong.
Okay. Thank you. Rick Kosopoulos.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, what Brian was presenting is the idea that every discharge that is significant in the Scott TMDL is going to end up with either a waiver or with a WDR. And it's true that we don't have a schedule yet for developing those waivers or WDRs, but in the back of our minds we're thinking in 2011 the conditional waiver will expire. And so part of the reason for doing this presentation now was just to do a comfort check with the board that you all understand where we're going, which is essentially these sources at some level, there will be a conditional waiver to pick up some of the miscellaneous stuff and to cover things that we aren't able to get to. And beyond that, we're looking that every category will have a waiver or a permit. And then the question is only the content of those documents, are they locally developed or do we basically write them? And so that's I just want to be clear that's where we're going, which I believe is consistent with the action plan, and would acknowledge that we're missing that key step of, some real dates that I think people who are reviewing it can get their teeth into, but wanted very much to check that people were comfortable with the direction we were going in before we developed a schedule of dates. I also wanted to make clear that we are not relying on Department Fish and Game's ITP program. If they get done, well, we will use them because it will be good. But there are a lot of questions. When we started the Scott Valley TMDL, they were way out in front of us, and the board adopted a implementation plan that relied very heavily on them. Well, we've kept on going, and they've kind of fallen behind for any number of very legitimate reasons, but they're behind us now. And so while we still hope that what they're going to put forward we will be able to rely on, at some level we're just keeping going and hoping that they get through their process and we can use it. Otherwise, we can't wait forever for them, but we hope that they will be successful.
Okay.
Yeah. My name is Rick Costalos. I'm the Natural Resource Policy Specialist for Siskiyou County. I didn't come over here for this reason, but a couple of comments occur from Brian's presentation. One is the issue on the planner. It's kind of a lame excuse for falling behind on the land development manual because we're unable to find staff, but the simple fact of the matter is we've been trying to fill this project for or this position for quite a while. And prior to the economic meltdown, we just weren't getting any applicants that were willing to work for the pittance that Siskiyou County was willing to pay. And as one of the fringe benefits of this economic thing, I think we've got almost 100 applications from all over the United States for this. So I look for this position to be filled fairly quickly to where we can make some progress. We certainly don't want to hire somebody that's just coming here from Chicago or something near Detroit, because GM's and they're going to head right back. But I look for some opportunity. They're pretty confident we're going to get some quality people working for the county to help move this along. The other thing is the database that is sought by May. I think the time you had for it is May of 2009. I was talking with Carolyn, Siskiyou RCD. I think a better word rather than develop on that database is refine. We have a fairly considerable database of what we've done, particularly since 2005, but it does need to be refined from the standpoint of accessibility for people to be like yourselves that want to know exactly what was done, where, and when, and that is more what is being going on as the refinement of that database. And one of the problems we are having is NRCS, the projects that they have done, we're having a hard, they can lump them all together in terms of how much fencing or how much this or how much that, but they can't be specific about where they've done them, things like that, because of the confidentiality agreement that they have. And I'm working with NRCS to try and find some way that we can, they're reluctant to go back and ask all the people they work for to if they can share the material. They don't want to really backtrack over all of that stuff. Trying to find out some way that we can, the RCD, the projects that they have participated in, they can track, but the ones that the NRCS and the landowners have done individually, it's going to be problematic, but I'm working with that. It's not like NRCS doesn't want to cooperate, it's just that their rules and regulations, but make it somewhat difficult. But the reason I came over here was recently there was an issue with regard to timber harvest plans and WDRs and the waiver program that occurred over in Scott River. They were associated with the TMDL and, you know, just the basic timber harvest rules. The Board of Supervisors requested Water Board staff to, you know, work with the county on this to, you know, to understand and you know, maybe find some agreement or some solutions to this issue. I want to reciprocate the effort that the Water Board staff made in responding to that request by promptly getting a hold of me and responding to the supervisor's request. And four of the senior staff went over there, Bob Clamp, Fred Blatt, David Leland, and Brian McFadden, came over, responded promptly, came over, worked with the timber industry, worked with the ag community, because that is one of the big issues that we had with this, is that it wasn't just the timber industry, but with, as is clear, the WDR and waiver program for ag is something that's on the horizon, and we needed to understand, you know, promote some confidence within the agricultural community, and that you know, there's some responsiveness on the part of the Water Board staff and some willingness to be adaptive, you know, acknowledging these water quality issues and how we can practically approach them and accomplish the water quality objectives at the same time, trying to keep everybody in business. And I think that as a result of the staff's effort and the timber industry folks and the ag folks that participated in this sit-down and meeting of the minds here, I think we established a relationship and a level of understanding that I think will help us move in the direction of achieving these water quality objectives with a minimum of screaming and hollering on this stuff. I think it was a very productive effort on the part of your staff. I think as well staff had a better sense of the timber industry and the ag folks and acknowledgement of these water quality objectives that they're charged, the water board staff is charged with. So all in all, I want to extend the supervisor's appreciation for your guys' response, your staff's response. Thank you.
Okay. We'll take appreciation from Siskiyou County supervisors. Yes, Daniel Myers first. Bill, hold on.
Good afternoon. Daniel Myers from the Redwood Chapter of the Sierra Club. I've been pushing the temperature TMDLs in the program. These the Scott and Shasta are the first two out of the box, and they're precedent. They're very important that we get them right. They're quite different in the needs of the two. The conditions are different on each river. In our presentation today, I heard maybe 80% sediment and a little bit on temperature. I'd like to see it the other way around. I think the temperature is a more important issue. There were some items on fencing, a little bit on planting that would take place, and the dominant issue on this case is the groundwater and its effect on the in-stream flow as well, the temperature of the water. Document indicates that that plan is based upon grant applications that will take place, and there's a date for that. And the next item of action is after they get the grant money doing the work. There's no date on that. And I'm a little concerned that the program may be one of hope in getting funding to do work that's critical to the temperature. And I would just like to pose the question back to staff as to whether I have that right or not, and whether we have everything we need to keep the temperature part of the groundwater study going. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like an answer to that question if I could. Thank you.
Just hold on, staff. When you come back, Bill Crum.
Bill Crum, president of the board at Siskiyou RCD. Brian, maybe we could we flip back a couple of charts here? I wanted to, because I'm specifically the one that of the third from the end that showed.
This one.
Yes, that's it. I wanted to address, there's a number of issues here I wanted to address to expand on what Brian said. And let me start with, because this is your... to your staff for the support and the prodding that they gave us with regards to this 319H grant. Brian in particular was very helpful in getting us focused on that and helping us with that application. That is a very, very important step for us, and as we've just heard today, actually, for sure that that grant is now approved. So that's a very important item for us, and again, your staff was very helpful on that. Let me run through the where we stand with regards to ending up with discussing with you the development of an overall watershed-wide repair and restoration plan, because I think we're a lot further along than you might. Than what you've heard might indicate. First of all, we have an existing grant. I talked about this a little bit when I met with you in October from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The date that grant is terminating is September, and most of the work is done on this, and our staff is currently in the RCD staff is currently in the process of putting together the draft document that basically goes back and analyzes 15 or 20 years of riparian restoration in the Scott. Takes a look at what's worked, what hasn't worked, where has it worked, why has it worked here, why hasn't it worked there, to serve as a guideline document, if you will, as we move forward with additional restoration projects. That plan, again, should be available, at least in draft form, later this summer. We've also had the National Riparian, Wayne Elmore's group for National Resource Conservation Service in a year or two ago, and they did some very useful work for us and gave us some guidance, and we're following some of the things that they suggested to enhance and increase the survivability of the riparian planning. Just as one example, what we now do in the case of willows and cottonwoods is we plant those late in the summer when we have the lowest level of water around the streams, and we dig down until we get below the water line, so that when we're planting these, and it's amazing how deep some of these willow shoots go to get them down to where there's a sustainable and continual source of water, because that's our big problem, is when we dry out in the late season, we've historically tended to lose a lot of these riparian planting. So that is one thing that has came out of the Elmore thing that seems to be working very well. The 319H grant itself, it's $344,000, I believe, has a major element of that is to do an in-depth survey of the Scott River from Callahan to Fort Jones. That's roughly 25 miles. We've made a preliminary assessment of where we believe this restoration work is going to take place, but the purpose of that further detailed study is to bring primarily to validate that we are in fact going after the area that is going to be the most productive for this restoration funding, but also to gather additional information that's going to be useful in the groundwater study that is under the development, which is under the direction of Dr. Harder at Davis. Part of that, following on that, there will be out of that will come a plan to utilize this $344,000. But what that really is going to be is a plan for the riparian restoration of the main stem of the Scott River between Callahan and Fort Jones. So it will be prioritized, but we envision that as being a plan of the type which Brian spoke of with regards to defining, you know, what should be needed, where it should be needed, and how we should proceed, and priorities within that. This involves both bank stabilization, bioengineering bank stabilization, and riparian planning. The watershed-wide permitting program with the Department of Fish and Game, which I'll come back and talk about a little bit at the end here, has within it riparian restoration requirements. We are required within that 10-year time frame to do 20 acres of riparian restoration. But before that begins, we're required to develop a riparian restoration priority plan. The watershed-wide permitting program with Fish and Game is what I would characterize as a coho-centric plan. The endangered species is being protected by this permitting program is the coho salmon. In our watershed, the coho spawns and rears in the cold water tributaries, primarily on the west side of the valley. So I would envision, although this hasn't been absolutely the full details have not been agreed with the Department of Fish and Game, I envision that the development of that restoration plan is going to focus on those tributaries because, again, we're a coho-centric plan. So, and I think we're required to do that in the first year or so that we have the permitting program in place from the Department of Fish and Game. So if you take those two items we've just talked about, we will have, coming out of the 319H, we will have a restoration plan for the main stem of the Scott coming out of the watershed-wide permitting program. I envision we will have the same thing, but primarily focused on the western tributaries. So and those two together encompass basically the entire watershed. So I think we will, in fact, have a restoration strategy plan and set of priorities set. Fencing. I talked with you a little bit about this in October. In excess of 30 miles of the Scott River within the Scott Valley is fully protected from livestock with the exception of one ownership, either through fencing or through land use that does not involve livestock. So from Callahan to the Meander Bridge, which is over 30 miles, there is no livestock access to the main stem of the Scott with the exception of one landowner that we still have not resolved. In addition to that, the French Creek Minor Creek watershed, or French Creek Minor Creek tributaries, Shackelford Mills Creek, and Sugar Creek are all fully fenced and protected. We still have a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of work to do on the East Fork, a lot of work to do on the South Fork, on Patterson Creek and on Kidder Creek and on Moffett Creek. So we're not short of things to do, but we have gotten a tremendous amount done. Also within the watershed-wide permitting program from the Department of Fish and Game, we are required to do 2 miles a year. But again, prior to that, we have to come up with a priority fencing plan to focus on those areas that are the most critical with regards to protecting the riparian area, and that is something, again, that is due within the first year that the permit is in place. So we don't have the comprehensive plan that Brian spoke to at this time, but I think we will in very short order. The groundwater study is moving forward. We've had a total of 12 community meetings in the last 3 years. The next step that Dr. Harder has identified and the Watershed Council is in concurrence with is to move forward with this initially installing the piezometers that he calls out. I forget the exact number, but there's several hundred of those that he would like to see installed ultimately. We're not going to install 200 at once. We're trying to go at it on a prioritized basis, obviously utilizing landowners that concur and agree allowed to have access. That's something the Watershed Council is working on now. Clearly, the community outreach, community education, we've made good progress. We're certainly not done. It's going to continue to be a very, very, very important issue to people, and we will continue to work on that. But we do expect later this year to be moving into the mode of securing funding to get the first installment of the piezometers installed. We continue with our static well monitoring. We're now moving into our fourth year. We have an excess of 40 wells that are monitored every month, 12 months of the year, that we track the static level in the well. So we're building the beginnings of a database to assist in the ultimate groundwater study. With regards to the watershed-wide permitting program, obviously I can't speak for the Department of Fish and Game. They are moving into the final stages of the CEQA process. The final EIR, their latest date is expected to be out about the 1st of July. So that's roughly the time frame. And then we will move into the implementation phase of that once that final EIR is published. Part of the reporting requirements and the data keeping requirements that are placed upon the landowners and the RCDs are extensive in this, far beyond what anything your staff has ever asked us to do. We have in place a very sophisticated database system. We are loading it with all the information we have. Part of the process is a full inventory as we sign up individual landowners in this program, which will flesh out that database. And in addition, any activities that the landowner undertakes on their own, they are required to inform us at the end of the year, inform Fish and Game if they've put in fence, if they've done some other thing that we wouldn't otherwise know of, then we're to hear from them on that. I think that pretty well concludes my comments. If there's any questions, of course, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Thank you. Board member, questions, comments?
Let me, I have here, and I grabbed what I had in my truck when I got it with Rick Costales today, and I carry around these. This is I've only have four, so I know you've got eight.
We can share.
Huh?
We can share.
You can share. This is a fact pamphlet that Fish and Game put out. They work closely with the RCDs and the Watershed Council and with SOSS, our Groundroots landowners group in the county. And so let me give you this. It answers a lot of the questions that the people have been asking, and I'm sure that you'd be interested in knowing. And I will, Kat, I'll make sure. Did you get this? Did the Fish and Game send these to you?
Yes, we got it.
So you've got some?
And we're rather disappointed in it.
From our view, it didn't talk about the crosswalk with the TMDL.
Thank you.
Bill?
Sure.
The pretending 1980 grant that you just have, $344,000.
Right.
How far will that take you? Is that, if you indicated that you're going to inventory and prioritize?
It should inventory and prioritize the focus can be the entire Scott, the entire main stem from Callahan to Fort Jones, which is 25 miles or so. To a sufficient level that we then can determine how the balance of $344,000 ought to be spent. And we don't anticipate spending it over the entire stretch of the river. Certainly not going to do the entire river. We're going to focus on the top priority sections, sections of the river. So, I think it's the intent that when we come out of there, we will have a fully developed plan for what we would want to do in the river, and then lead us as to where we will do the actual hard development that the balance of the plan, the balance of the grant provides.
So what you're saying is that $344,000 will not buy the whole 25
miles? Oh, no.
Would you gander or estimate what the total cost per river mile of something like that would cost?
It's going to be, we have an enormous issue with regards to the dredger tailings, which run from Callahan to what's called Young's Point, a distance of, probably 8 miles, 8-9 miles, where dredger tailings were pulled out, 50 to 75 years ago. That section alone, to fully restore that, is going to take, I don't know, millions and millions and millions. We are working perhaps in one area there where Larry Alexander has done some work before to go the next step with regards to the riparian planning. That is one of the possible target areas. But to address the tailings issue per se is way outside the scope of this program.
Can I also ask you, because you've come before us before and talked about the water master and banking water and buying out.
Right.
What do you do through a drought year this year in that regard?
We have funding. This is going to be a good test year because how dry it's going to be, we don't know yet. Won't know for some time, although certainly the streams look pretty low. But that funding is there, and we will be, what those funds are being used for now is they're very, very targeted. They're targeted to maintain the integrity of the habitat in those areas where the coho oversummer. So it's really focused primarily on the tributaries that have the primary coho populations. You don't need typically these are pretty well shaded tributaries. You don't need a lot of water, but you certainly need some, and it has to be cold. So, you know, 1 or 2 CFS can make a tremendous difference in one of these tributaries, whereas it doesn't even have any impact on the main stem.
So what I hear is that's happening again. That's a fall program, is it not?
That's a midsummer to fall program.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's on this year.
It is.
It's a big test, probably.
Yes. Yes, we have funding.
Okay.
Yes, Bob.
Well, Bill, in terms of, we've heard of the need for a comprehensive plan, and I guess my question is just, do we know what we need to know in order to pick the sites that are best for restoration and most contributory to the problem, or do we? We're not there yet.
You never have enough information, obviously. You never get perfect. We have done a lot, our staff and others have done a lot of studies, particularly in the tributaries with regards to, again, coho-related issues, because that is the gun at the head, so to speak, because of the endangered species listing. So we know an awful lot about which areas of the tributaries are going to benefit the most from additional restoration work, from introducing in-stream structures to aid in rearing of coho, and in spawning gravel programs and that kind of thing. So yeah, we were in very good shape there. We probably, you know, one of the things that have looked at here recently is looking more closely at what's happening in the main stem, and we're finding, you know, up till fairly recently, the only truly analytical data we had on water temperatures in the main stem was what came out of the TMDL work, the FLIR studies. And, you know, those give a very good overall view of what the temperatures in the main stem are, but they're taken aerially and they don't get into what's going on underneath the surface of the water. And we've done this last summer, for example, Dr. Harder was able to arrange it's University of Nevada, system that utilizes fiber optics, and we actually had a mile or a 2 mile long fiber optic cable that we were able to drift down in the Scott River, and found a lot of places where there was cold water coming from a seep or from some other source that maybe we suspected but didn't know about before. So we've got a lot more, and that's one of the things that we'll be doing in the preliminary work here is better understanding what's going on in the main stem of the Scott, because even though it really gets very, very low in the summer, there still are some spots where there is cold water and the coho and coho will over summer. So, you know, we've got a lot more information to gather, but one of the purposes of this, to utilize this money, is to add to that information base so we are more intelligently, you know, spending the money that we're spending in restoring that river.
And then I would say there are a lot of initiatives, a lot of programs, efforts underway, as I gather, in the Scott. But the question of the day is how we stand in terms of the deadline laid out in 2011. We've heard some testimony that it's not likely we're going to make it. I would characterize, I guess, staff as leaning that way. Where do you stand on that?
Well, certainly we're committed to achieving everything that we submitted to your staff, which with regards to the timelines that are laid out there. We feel very confident that we can achieve those objectives. In some cases, it depends upon, you know, doing the work, depends upon achieving the grant or the grant funding. I wish there were more specificity with regards to implementing the groundwater study. We recognize, certainly the RCD and the Watershed Council recognize that that's a very important thing. We've got a tremendous resource in the support we're getting from UC Davis. There aren't many places in this world that you can get that quality of technical professional expertise for free. Being so it's University of California, that, you know, we are not charged for Dr. Herder's time. So that's a tremendous resource for us. and but you know, we are actively looking for funding sources. We heard of one through BOR just the other day that while it doesn't, it, because of the way the funding is set up, it isn't. For example, it won't directly fund our water trust, but it might fund water trust activities through the local irrigation district, just because of the way that that funding mechanism works. And with regards to the next important step the next important thing is to get this preliminary model from Dr. Harder, but that's something that basically is under his control and is going to happen. The next thing from our standpoint is to, as he's identified and we're in agreement with, is to start moving forward and getting these piezometers installed, which is going to make the database more robust.
Okay. Other board members?
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to resist, Rick, if I can. I see, I believe someone from the Forest Service is. Any comments? No? If you need to, Rick, I'll take you. You want to make your point?
Yeah.
You want, you come forward. And
to answer your question about the 2011 deadline, I think that's a key question in all of this stuff. And one of the concerns that's in my mind, and that I'm sure everybody's aware of with this, is just the controversial nature of a lot of the requirements and the people, as Felice referred to, on, you know, you've got the environmental community and then you've got the other community that's, you know, just saying, oh gosh, this is some big government takeover or some kind, you know, all kinds of conspiracy type stuff. The biggest obstacle I see to accomplishing this 2011 deadline is making mistakes that will tend to augment the argument of those people on that side, to where it does appear to be a heavy-handed attitude, and there are things that appear to be not making sense and not really working in the direction of accomplishing those goals. So as long as I feel confident that we'll meet that deadline, as long as that, you know, things aren't forced into that realm to where there just is a massive sense of opposition. So that's okay. My answer to your question. Thank you.
Brian, have you come back? Question was raised by Mr. Myers. You want to respond to that?
I believe the question was related to funding for the groundwater study. There's a few things to mention here. First of all, Dr. Harder's time has been donated, or, you know, that's his job, but he has a grad student that works for him that isn't free, and we've been paying for his time and also for some outreach time for the RCD staff to spend. We are going to put another, to date we have $105,000 of our TMDL contract dollars sunk into this project, and we're about to sink in another $75,000 more. So that's one thing I want to make sure you're aware of. Some number of months back, I don't recall exactly what month it was in, the Watershed Council invited Dan McManus from Department of Water Resources to come and describe Department of Water Resources grant program for funding community groundwater programs. And he made it very clear that a key criteria for their funding is a groundwater management plan. He also made it clear that that groundwater management plan can be a lot of different things. There isn't hard criteria associated with that grant that spells out what needs to be in that groundwater management plan. I think the pieces are already there, as does Dr. Harder, to put together and have a plan that functions as a groundwater management plan for Scott Valley, so that they could go after the quite sizable funds that are available through that program. But to date, there's been a reluctance to define anything as a groundwater management plan. To me, that I have a hard time with that. And it seems to me like there needs to be some more effort to make that happen if all the pieces are in place. And DWR is indicating that they want to support such an effort, and it's just a matter of terminology. Groundwater management plan, that scares people. I understand that they're fearful, but how many times are we going to sink our contract dollars into this program? You know, I've been the one at our office supporting that and pushing for that. But I mean, there's a point where we have to say, you know, enough is enough. We got to start spending our money on the Russian, which is the next TMDL coming up. So I'm concerned about that, and I think there's some opportunity there for the community to take it a bit further. Does that answer your question, Dan? I also want to be real clear about what I'd said regarding the criteria. And I don't think I said, and I certainly didn't mean to say, that that we're disregarding what's in the action plan and the basin plan. That's not how we operate. What I meant to say, and I think I said, was that all those processes that I identified either have erosion control plans as part of the process or have a process that serves the same function, including inventory, prioritize, schedule, and implement. That is our model for an erosion control plan, so we're not giving up on that. And similarly, with the permitting framework for grazing and riparian management, I think what we're doing there is instead of taking a small step to define the criteria, we're taking a much larger step and saying, yeah, we're defining criteria and also how we're going to use that criteria in a regulatory framework that's compliant with the non-point source policy. So just wanted to clarify that.
All right. At this juncture, Chair is a bit confused as to what the next step should be. If you want board comments, it's really informational. On the other hand,
Can I add one more thing? There's the talk about the 2011 deadline and meeting that. Let's be real clear here. What that deadline says is, or it's what the 2011 date, where that comes from, is a five-year trial period to see whether self-directed activities are going to be sufficient for implementation of the TMDL. There was no water quality condition that has to be met at that point. It entirely relies on this board's judgment regarding the satisfaction of progress. That's what the action plan says.
No. And the board would reserve that. That is our job, to evaluate at that milestone whether or not we did what we set out to do, or we fell short. And,
if I may, the reason why we're bringing it to you now halfway through the five-year period is that in 2011, in September, I believe is the date, we have to either extend the conditional permit or replace it. I don't think it's going to be acceptable to just extend what we have right now. I think that's what we did before, as you will recall, we did as basically make-up work because we hadn't, when the board adopted the TMDL, we forgot to comply with the non-point source policy, and the state pointed it out to us. And so we went back and did a really very quick fix in order to meet the consent decree. And I think what you're hearing from us right now is we don't have a recommendation for you. I think we're struggling with this, and so we wanted to share our pain with you and see if you had any wisdom to impart. In order to meet that 2011 date, we need to now be, I think, pushing ourselves pretty hard as to whether or not what we're seeing, do we think it's going to translate to essentially in a year from now, December, say 2010, are we in a position to start writing waivers and WDRs that take us the next step? So we move from something that is just something, an effort-based conditional permit, which basically said you do good things, you're covered, to something that it says, okay, that the community went ahead and did those good things, and they've come up with the following recommendation, and that's what goes in the waiver, versus we come up with something for them. So in order to get to there, we really in this next year are very much going to need to, in working with the community and with the board, make some evaluation as to is what's being developed at the local level, is it enough that we can pick it up and put it into a waiver? Or does the board want to entertain simply doing another conditional waiver that is effort-based and not outcome-based? So I think that's what we're wrestling with, and I don't have a recommendation for you other than wanted to make sure that you knew this is out there, and any thoughts or other analysis that you think we should be doing in order to inform your decision-making. It would be nice to know that now. Would it be useful to have more schedules so you can kind of see how the timeline would work? I'm sort of struggling with what would help you make that decision, so really in a year from now we're going to be seeking specific direction from you on what to deliver for a board meeting in 2011.
Well, I'll give some direction from my own self in terms with this chart on the wall here of scheduled locally directed efforts. I think there needs to be a companion chart to the other component that you had, is the staff directed efforts, and that we evaluate both sides of the equation and see where we stand. And before saying yay or nay, I'm happy with the state of those, I need more framework. I mean, I did appreciate, and it was a thought going through the PowerPoint, that there are a lot of pieces, but they don't ever really come together. Well, they started to come together on this chart. I'm telling you, the second part of the same chart, one piece of paper where those are analyzed and given some evaluation. I mean, if they don't have an effect, they don't get on the paper. And if they do, how far did we move on the dial? Did we get 80% of the way there, or are we still back at 5% of the start? How far along, and how big a piece are those? That's one comment. Another comment is compliance and trends. There's a report that's out. I haven't seen it. I haven't read it. Don't know if trend data suggests that it's all flat, nothing's improving, or it's all going in the up direction, or all going in the down direction, or, you know, the data's got gaps and it's not useful guidance. I don't know, but to me, we should have that kind of information in order to make an informed decision as to if we're making progress or not. Maybe it's too short a time, but that interests me. And then, Brian, you mentioned at the beginning sending out a letter similar to what was sent in Shasta. I'm not quite sure how it is we're at this point and we're starting to think about sending a letter to the folks out there. If that's one of the paths we're supposed to be walking down, I don't think we've done a very good job of getting very far down that path if we're just thinking about sending a letter out asking people, do you want to participate and cover yourself through this conditional waiver, if we've already done it in the neighboring valley and now we're just thinking about doing it in this valley. And I would offer that, you know, to me, as it was suggested, this was one of the TMDL's first out of the box. There's things in it that we might not put in it today. We've learned some things along the way, so that will be part of my evaluation when I'm around here in 2011 when we decide change course or not. And I would just end my comment just that, you know, I do think we're at the halfway point, and for the locals, I would suggest that we've loaded the cannon and we're ready to fire the shot, go to a different approach, consider different, you know, there's, again, I would characterize, I've heard some disgruntlement that it's not going as well as we had hoped, and we need to accelerate on the making it happen between now and 2011 in order for it to work the way we hoped it would work.
Chair?
Mr. Hill.
I'd like to add on to what you said, specifically with what did the trends show us. I'd like to say that we should broaden our evaluation not to look at solely trends, but to look at the processes as well, because the processes link us to cause and effect relationships rather than what simply a trend can tell us. And from there, we can base adaptive decisions on how do we steer the ship? What do we need to nudge left or nudge right to make that change? I think that what we have at this point is information that's being collected for the three main points that Mr. McFadden has outlined for the Scott TMDL. Those main points: controlling excess sediment discharges, increasing riparian shade, and understanding how groundwater use affects stream temperatures. We're making some very measurable progress toward understanding the first two, sediment discharges and increasing riparian shade, based on what work cooperative folks, RCD, and everybody else is working with and what we're learning about. And it seems that one of the big unknowns here is the groundwater study, simply because of the magnitude of what needs to be undertaken with that. And there's over 100 piezometers that still need to be installed, and we're trying to make progress toward a 2011 deadline. And having done this work in this field, that's a very, very ambitious goal. So I think that that's probably where we would want to definitely focus a little bit of soul searching to see, you know, what do we need to do here.
Mr. Massey.
Mr. Chair, it's really a question for probably Mr. Crum, because until 5 minutes ago, the assumption was that everything was going to 2011, just dandy, and now we're saying yes, but if it doesn't, that there may be something else that happens. And so is this something that, and I'm asking you, Mr. Crum, as a representative of the entire community, is that a well-understood concept that this is just... this is not the final step. This is not the final solution. That there's the possibility of many other things happening.
Let me make sure I understood your question. Your question was, speaking to the community as an entity, is it well understood that the current waiver program is just that, just a waiver that could, to use the chair's colorful terminology, is a loaded cannon that could go in a different direction. I would say no, I don't believe it is. Certainly there are the people that have been working on the TMDL effort, the board, the staff of the RCD, the people who are actively participating in the watershed, in the Scott River Watershed Council, county staff, they understand that. The community as a whole, no. Rural communities are interesting to deal with in that regard. And probably the best meeting we've had on the TMDLs was the one that Brian referred to earlier, where he and David and I don't know if Kat was there or not, but came up and addressed the Watershed Council. We had very good participation, probably had, 40 people or so at that meeting?
Yeah.
And I think that, the challenge that we face, when I'm taking we, I'm narrowing, I'm not an Aurora we, I'm getting more focused to those individuals, those organizations within the community that are trying to simultaneously meet the needs and requirements of the regulatory framework in the context of very independent property rights-oriented landowners is that it gets to the issue that Rick Costales raised earlier. If you push so hard, if you hit people with so much information, what happens, you know, and you can see it when you're somebody, you see the eyes glaze and you know you've lost them. And, you know, there is currently, Felice referred to it, I think he's referring to a rather limited fringe element that gets quoted in our local paper and our local paper itself, but nonetheless, as the Fish and Games program is moving towards implementation, it is raising the temperature level in the community. So you know, we constantly have this risk of losing our constituents. We have to keep people involved, and that's why we spend so much time in outreach. That's why we've met 12 times in 3 years talking about groundwater. Getting back to your specific point, no, I think we need to get the community to understand that what the possible future ramifications, implications, manifestations of the Clean Water Act and the Port of Cologne could have on the individual landowners, both from a cost standpoint, from a permitting standpoint, and whatnot, and what we can do to avoid that. And some of the, you know, when we've talked about the groundwater study, we've brought people in from the outside. We brought in a gentleman from Colusa County who had tremendous experience and background in dealing with these issues, both as a landowner and as an ag commissioner and as the individual who was one of the primary promoters of developing a good groundwater management plan for Colusa County. And when he laid out the, you know, you do it for yourself or somebody comes in and does it for you kind of logic, then you could see that people understood that. But we need to do more of that. And I think that, you know, your staff, you know, it doesn't, one of the things that I have discovered, and it's not a revelation, but sitting there as a resource conservation district, if we start putting out the message from the regulatory agencies, then pretty soon the community can't tell us from the regulatory agencies. And it's a major, major problem that we need to contend with. So, you know, we really can't put that message out there. That message has to come from on the fishery side, has to come from Fish and Game, and from on the water quality, it has to come from you. And I, you know, Brian, there is a meeting scheduled next month. I think we need to get very good attendance there. We need to get people to understand what the law is, what the where we are in that process, and where the possible branches that we could go from there, and what needs to be done to stay in a more benign, yeah, we want to control our own destiny, we want to do it ourselves. It's not easy. It is. It's not easy. I mean, you have volunteer boards who end up being subject of no limited amount of derision.
It's only because I recognize that from being from a small community and understanding the rural nature of things and so forth that I understand that, and I also understand that we have a responsibility to make sure that this works. And so it's a pitfall that I can see, and I think it's something that we all need to work on to make sure that when the day is done, we have a TMDL that works. We have restoration. We have the things that we set out to do in the first place. And I don't know how you overcome those hurdles in your community, if you will, because I know what mine looks like, and it may not work in yours. It's just a matter of making sure that everybody understands that this board has to do what this board is charged with, and I'm sure you understand that, but for you to convey that to others is maybe very difficult. And I just want to make sure that we all are cognizant of that.
Yeah. Everybody in this room is, yeah. But it's going to take a lot more work. It's going to take a lot more work. But, you know, the other side of it is the alternative is not very attractive.
No,
and it's not only is not, I would submit, it's not only not attractive from our landowner's standpoint, it's not very attractive from yours and your staff standpoint.
It's really not.
If you're constantly battling getting access to land and doing the things that really, you know, sure, you can introduce a punitive regulatory regimen, but does that really take you down the road of making things better? Well, you need the cooperation of these individual landowners. We need their cooperation. This 319H program. We will need the cooperation of every single landowner where we want to do this restoration project, or we're not going to be able to go on their property. Now, I think we're going to be able to get that, but we have to keep the positive relationship in order to do that. So,
I can tell you just from experience talking to our staff, when they get cooperation out of landowners, they come back from Siskiyou County just happy as they can be.
Yeah.
I mean, because it is. They understand.
Yeah. Well, and your staff's done an excellent job to date in the Scott Valley with regards to, we had some rough spots in getting the TMDL approved. There's no question about that. But since that time, I think it's been very good. But we need to do more.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Other board member comments? Ms. Norton.
Actually, I think this is all really good. I think Jeff mentioned adaptive decisions, and it seems to me that this whole process is about adaptive decisions. This program that was laid out by Brian McFadden today really tries to rectify and adapt this in implementation to this. As part of that, I think that it's important to have outcomes that are realistic, and also I agree, actually, with number one, that the reporting is a key part of that. I think that there's many pieces and parts of this program that it's pieced out and parsed out. So how do we come together and get information to evaluate it ourselves? But also, I think community, a rural community, like Mr. Massey said, is about building trust and getting access to properties and landowners and getting willing cooperation, because it isn't attractive to have to go out there and enforce. So how do we do that? I think that part of this could be, along the way, is to help on the reporting side. Do we do an annual report of some kind? Do we maybe issue a report card? And this is maybe just really nuts and bolts kind of thing, but how do we evaluate the effectiveness of individual or collective actions on the whole watershed or of a piece of a project or a project in whole comprehensively? Do we have a repository for information? Do we put this on a website? Do we publish it publicly in one spot? That's just a piece of it. I think it's all adaptive at some point. And I recognize, too, that this right here tries to adapt this TMDL as it goes along. That's the main point of this. And I think this is very good, by the way. It goes a long ways, I think, to trying to get implementation here. The devil's going to be in the details whether we get it by September 2011. And it is going to be tough. It is. So I think this is very good. It's a very good step.
You may.
Pressure.
I just would like to say that I really appreciate the work of the RCD and the NRCS and our staff working collaboratively in that community. And I also recognize that as we enter into who knows how long the state of our economy will be the way that it is, that spending that money on those miles of fence that we would like to see the landowners spend or even look for grant funding or anything may become harder. And I work with landowners on a regular basis, and I know for a fact that metal fence posts have gone from anywhere from $1.50 to $2 to about $6 a piece. And so when we're talking miles of fence and we're talking stream bank restoration and we're talking, you know, the activity that it takes to fund all of those things, we're talking about a commodity that a lot of people don't have that they used to have, and that's money. And so I would like to encourage all of us to remember the reality of our times. Conservation is highly important. It's the predecessor to our children's ability to produce agriculture in this country. And I personally believe that our ability to produce our own food is one of our country's greatest national defenses, because we could survive if we need to, based off of what our land gives us. And so I would just like to encourage with heart the folks who are working with those landowners, but also recognize that we're not the only ones who are asking the landowners to make changes. There's a lot of changes that are happening in their worlds that they have no control over. There are finances that are being taken from areas that were historically their nest eggs or their, you know, retirement sources or what have you. I look at this maybe from a different perspective than some, because I am a landowner. And my father owns a small water company. And when you go to attack those requirements, the paperwork is unsurmountable at times. And so we're standing in a little bit of different shoes than we were when we passed the TMDL for this region. And so I would just like to encourage everyone, but let's keep in mind the heart that's in the folks that we're working with, and from both the management perspective and the landowner's perspective. And just, you know, we might have to look at things in different ways, and we may have to find it out. We may have to not necessarily invent new wheels, but look for opportunities to make things happen differently. And that's just my statement to close all of this. But it's a lot of good work that's happening out there. And sometimes when we look at the mountain in front of us, we forget to turn around and look back at the mountain we've already climbed. And so let's not leave this conversation about this area of folks thinking of how much more we have to do, but applaud ourselves for the accomplishments that have already been made. And it's with those accomplishments that the path that's in front of us can be accomplished, based off of good experiences. So keep up the good work up there in those mountains. We appreciate everything that everyone does. And good job, Ryan. You're working with folks who would probably just much rather never see you. but they do, and I'm sure after they spend a little bit of time with you, they realize that you're a good guy, and that you have their intentions at heart, and you're in a tough spot. You got to please the board, you got to please the state, and you got to please the landowners, and that's always not an easy thing to do. So keep your head up and keep working.
Well, you know, I just kind of flippantly said I've heard that before, but mostly I'm greeted with a lot of civility and sincerity in regards to the process, and so I didn't want to leave that comment standing. But thank you.
Carol?
It sure is.
I'd like to also compliment you for all of your hard work, and as well as the people in the community. I know how difficult it is to get people to come together and work together and to build that trust. And I agree with what's been said about the reporting. I think that is going to be an important item that we're going to have to look at. I think people need to see the relationships between cause and effect. And if the reporting can show the cause and effect and even unintended consequences, that understanding helps foster more cooperation and also helps answer questions that both sides have, those that are for it, those that are against it. So the reporting of cause and effect, I think, would be extremely important in keeping things moving forward. And again, I commend the community for trying to come together and work on this, and I commend you for all of your efforts in keeping us informed. This is my first TMDL, and it's been a kind of a daunting process from what I can tell, but I see a lot of progress, and I see it moving forward, and I appreciate it.
Okay. Ms. Coleman.
Always, you know, the person. I don't want to end on a negative note, but I do have to express my concern to you that this is not going. You know, David Norton, you made the suggestion of a report card, which I think is an excellent idea. Our problem is we don't have anything to measure against right now. You can't measure environmental trends in the time frame we're looking at. So we're really looking at an activity-based report card. We don't have any. We have very few requirements right now to measure whether or not we are making progress against those. And I think that's what we're as staff, really struggling with is how do we evaluate when we really don't have anything to evaluate against, because the action plan didn't give us much to evaluate against. So that's the piece I think we need to try to wrestle with in the next year or so, of how do we get with the community, with Fish and Game, with community activists, and get some things that we all agree and we can move forward and we can see whether or not we are making progress on the activities, as well as really buffing up and getting a good way of looking over the longer term at the environmental trends. We just know right now that the fish are, you know, they're almost, the coho are almost gone out of this river valley. They're almost gone. And that's where we are.
Cheery note.
Thanks. All right. I am going to leave it there. And I think it's appropriate. And, you know, we're not at the end. So thank you, Brian. Thank you all for your comments. And we will move along. Final items on today's agenda. Get back to it.